From NPR News, you're listening to a live version of the Best of Weekends and All Things Considered. It's not live. It can't be. It's a podcast. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturdays and Sundays. This episode, how Geraldine Ferraro shamed George H.W. Bush back in 1984. Also, insanely scary stories from air traffic controllers, plus the amazing story of how a lost roll of film led a Brooklyn hipster to Paris. And later, the secret nuclear bunker Congress never used. We'll also talk to physicist Michio Kaku about invisibility cloaks and internet-ready contact lenses. He says the technology is there. Believe me, it sounds crazy, but he says that. And Swedish indie queen Leaky Lee on vampires, winter darkness, and her new record, of course. That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. Enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, my name is Geraldine Ferraro.
Geraldine Ferraro's famous acceptance speech at the 1984 Democratic Convention. When Walter Mondale selected her as his running mate, the two made history. This morning, Geraldine Ferraro died. She was 75. For women across the country, Ferraro represented the possibility of change.
You want more for your kids than you had. And that's the American dream.
Mondale and Ferraro, bringing a new fairness to America.
The Mondale-Ferraro ticket was defeated by Reagan Bush in a landslide. They only carried one state. But Ferraro's legacy could be seen in the positions women eventually achieved in American politics. One of her friends in Congress and a leading advocate for women's equality is former Congresswoman Patricia Schroeder. She served for 25 years, and she joins me now on the line from her home in Florida. Congresswoman, thank you for being with us.
Well, it's so nice to talk to you, although what a sad day this is. She's a very good friend of mine, and I last saw her just several months ago at her 50th wedding anniversary. Mm. So it's very sad. She wanted to live even longer, and unfortunately we don't get to pick that out, do we?
She was, of course, diagnosed with cancer in 1998 and survived up until now. I wanted to ask you, Patricia Schroeder, if you could give us a sense of Geraldine Ferraro's impact on the role women would eventually play in American politics.
Well, you know, I thought she played such a prominent role, and people got so comfortable with seeing her on the ticket that I went out and said I didn't think we'd ever see a ticket without a woman going forward, and obviously I was very wrong. But nevertheless, I do think that for many, many young girls across America, they saw her and they thought, you know, that's terrific. I could do that. And as you know, in 1992, we had a huge surge of women coming into the Congress. And I think part of that was the fallout from the 84 campaign. It took them a little while to get organized and going. But once they did, they were ready. And I think that legacy is the most important. It was the role model. She could be a mother. She could be all these wonderful things, and she could also be a leader.
Pat Schroeder, I want to play a clip of tape for you. This is from a 1984 vice presidential debate. This is between Ferraro and then Vice President George H.W. Bush. Take a listen.
Let me help you with the difference, Ms. Ferraro, between Iran and the embassy in Lebanon. Iran, we were held by a foreign government. In Lebanon, you had a wanton terrorist action where the government opposed it.
Congresswoman Ferraro.
Let me just say, first of all, that I almost resent, Vice President Bush, your patronizing attitude that you have to teach me about foreign policy.
Pat Schroeder, was this a pivotal moment? I mean, when she stood up to Bush and called him on what sounded like a pretty patronizing tone.
Well, it was a patronizing tone. You could almost see him thinking of her as a five-year-old sitting on his knee, and he had to tell her, you just couldn't understand this, honey. And I thought it was wonderful that she called him on it rather than just politely glide over it. Bless her heart. She was born and raised in New York, and she knew how to, you know, call him. And she called him, and that's why so many people really saluted her.
Now, nearly 30 years after her bid, we have three women on the Supreme Court right now. We've had a woman, Speaker of the House, three Secretaries of State, another vice presidential candidate. Is this the legacy of Jerry Ferraro?
Yes, I think it is. I think all of those things are part of her legacy. And I think also lots of other young women that we don't even know their names yet that are coming along that saw her and were inspired. I just think about when I was growing up, there were no women in politics. It just never even occurred to me that you could go into politics. And I think Jerry really did that. She opened that for everybody.
That's former Colorado Congresswoman Patricia Schroeder. She served in the House of Representatives for nearly 25 years and knew Geraldine Ferraro well. Pat Schroeder, thank you so much for your memories.
Thank you.
American 1900, so you're aware, the tower is apparently not manned.
That was the explanation given to a plane trying to land at Washington's Reagan National Airport this past week when pilots on two commercial airliners heard no response from the air traffic control tower.
Is there a reason it's not manned?
The eventual answer to that question was that the controller had fallen asleep. But another possibility may have been because all of the good controllers were in Las Vegas. It was in Vegas that same day that the National Air Traffic Controllers Association was meeting to recognize the top controllers from across the country, the men and women who made life-saving calls from the tower. And we spoke to a few of the winners.
A lot of people don't understand what happens when you take off in an airplane. They just think you go and come back.
I think they put a lot of faith in the entire system.
Yeah, getting their luggage on time and you know, seeing their family, which, you know, that's important to them.
Just have flown on a plane. They know they get from point A to point B safely. What a great thing for us it is that acceptance is so innate in people that they don't even question it anymore. All right, my name's Chuck LeBombard.
Columbia 3-4 kilo, descend and maintain 5,000.
What you're hearing is the voice recording of the actual incident, September 26, 2010.
Burlington, I'm sorry, I'm very uncomfortable with my fuel level.
This particular individual, as she was flying into our airport, she became apparently disoriented and made a 180-degree turn back into the face of an E-190 jetliner. And the tower controller was able to pry them apart, as we call it. And then the real fun began.
Altitude alert, climb immediately, ma'am. Climb immediately and maintain 5,400.
Hey, I'm up, but please get me.
She was extremely shaky, and that was probably the hardest thing that I had to deal with.
Sorry, I can't do a VOR. I'm too nervous.
I wouldn't say start yelling at her.
4 kilo, the airport should be directly ahead of you, 12 o'clock and 2 miles.
Giving her...
Am I over the center of it?
...the final headings that she needs to get to the airport.
You're not quite there yet, ma'am. It's 2 miles ahead of you, 2 miles ahead of you.
And she says, I see the tower.
Hey, I see the airport, I see the tower. I'm heading right at you.
I got to tell you.
Okay, 3-4 kilo, find a runway and land on it.
Those were the most beautiful words I'd ever heard.
Thank God, 3-4 kilos down.
3-4 kilo, contact tower now.
My name is Derek Bittman.
Maintain 3,500 until Carroll.
It was a light civil aircraft. The guy came down, bought an airplane in Illinois for a friend, and was flying it back down to the Atlanta area to deliver it. It was a new plane, and there was something wrong with the landing instruments. As it turned out, the weather got bad on them, and low ceilings, so the clouds were low in the area of Atlanta. Then to top it all off, he's had made so many attempts that he is actually running out of gas.
Say, fuel on board, please.
Time remaining is 45 minutes, 1-1 November.
November, Roger. November, I'm going to declare emergency on your behalf, sir. Let me know what you need, and we'll make it happen right now.
He's flying blind with no instruments.
I think my VOR that I'm using to actually find the airport is malfunctioning.
You basically talk the aircraft down. You tell him turn right a little bit, turn left a little bit. There's a mountain range on the northern side of the airport. So he was a little bit nervous to descend. I guess he was getting scared and just turning right or turning left and climbing out of the approach because he was getting scared.
Left, of course. Suggest a right turn about 5 degrees. November 1-1 November.
I don't know. I just did what I thought I needed to do, what he needed to get on the ground and not die.
and I believe they have a fair amount of wide highways and stuff. So if you see something that you like and you don't think you can make the airport, please let me know what you're planning.
Got them down to about, I can't remember what it was. I've only seen this a couple times because it makes me nervous every time I watch it and, or hear it. But but as soon as he got through that cloud deck, he saw the airport and, you know.
Airport Insights. Atlanta, thank you, sir.
We're all very happy for him. A buddy of mine, we went out to kind of talk a little bit outside the building, and I remember feeling lightheaded, and I had to sit down. My wife is a controller, too, and she has trouble flying now because she works air traffic control. She doesn't like flying because, like, one bad decision can lead to a very bad error. She understands the risk. You know, we all understand the risk. I guess some of us just put it in the back of our mind better.
That's Derek Bittman. This past week, he won the award for Best Flight Controller Assist of the Year from the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. We also heard from Chuck LeBombard, who was recognized for Outstanding Flight Assist in the New England region. Here's another story we came across this past week. Remember that huge blizzard that hit New York last December? Well, the next day, a guy called Todd Bieber decided to strap on a pair of old skis and trek across Prospect Park in Brooklyn, where he lives. And here's what happened.
While I was out there skiing around, I stopped at one point just to catch my breath, and I looked down, and I saw a canister of film.
The first thing that came to his mind was, who uses film anymore? Todd thought about tossing the roll back into the snow, but then he remembered something a friend once told him.
Fun stories happen when you make choices you wouldn't normally make. And so normally when I find a piece of garbage in the ground, I'd just leave it sit, or I'd pass by it, or I'd throw it away, or something like that. And I was like, you know, there's probably something in here.
So Todd shoved the film into his pocket, and he took it to a developer. And when he went back to pick the photos up a few days later,
they gave me the envelope, and I opened it up, and it was just these amazing pictures of the blizzard.
It was like a photo tour of the city.
Coney Island, Central Park, they went to the Brooklyn Bridge. The film was black and white. All of the modern cars and modern technology was just buried, covered in snow. You're just left with, like, old school New York.
In a few of the photos, there were these two men, handsome, fashionably dressed, maybe European.
And then they ended up, you could see the last few photos were taken just a few steps from where I found the film, and it was like, whoa, this is awesome. I gotta do something cool with this.
Now, wherever these guys were from, Todd wanted to find them. So he made a video about his find, and he posted it to YouTube, and he asked the question, do you know any of these people?
I put it out there, not expecting much. When it got 1,000 views, I was like, okay, cool, 1,000 views. Then it got 10,000 views. And the next thing I know, within like 4 days, it had 1,000,000 views, and it was everywhere.
Hundreds of people sent him emails, people around the world offering him clues and tips.
My favorite was, based on the hairstyle, they said that they were from Turkey.
But no solid leads came through, and after a few months, Todd was about to give up on the whole thing. But then he got an email from a woman named Camille, and she wrote,
"That's my family, those are my pictures."
And those mysterious men, they were Camille's brothers, and as proof, she sent Todd other photos she'd taken that day on a different camera.
I saw her family, and I saw the snow, and I was like, this is real.
After a few emails back and forth, Camille and Todd talked on the phone, and she suggested that he mail her the photos, but Todd didn't want it to end that way.
And within a few hours of getting that phone call, my girlfriend and I booked a trip to Paris.
Todd tapped into his new network of friends, people all over Europe who saw the video and offered to buy him a beer or a crash pad if he ever passed through. So he loaded his backpack and left Brooklyn.
He started in Belgium, Germany, down to Switzerland, down to Italy.
Paris was his last stop, and that's where he met Camille, in a cafe. Where else?
No, but it was New York.
Now, if all of this sounds romantic, it is, definitely. But the reality of it was that, for Todd, it was strangely awkward.
Unlike all the other people that I met who had, like, reached out to me and greeted me with open arms, like, she didn't choose to be part of this. She just woke up one morning, and all of a sudden her family photos were this viral video.
Todd videotaped the meeting, and over a few days he got to know Camille. He found out she was a student studying urban planning.
She doesn't consider herself a photographer.
And they both agreed the whole thing was like something out of a movie.
Did you see Amélie?
That's Camille asking Todd if he'd seen the film Amélie.
After that French movie, Amélie, where the girl finds the pictures and the things and then leaves them or and then gives them back to the owner.
Of course, in the movie, Amélie falls in love with the film's owner. Todd, you'll remember, has a girlfriend.
I'm very happy in that relationship.
But the movie did inspire a different ending to Todd's story. During his trip, he'd been taking his own photos. He took a few final shots with Camille and her brother, and then they put the film canister outside the Café de Du Moulin in Montmartre, the same restaurant where Amélie works in the film. And in the canister, they left a note.
So, like, I'll put...
It said...
It happened once.
It happened once. It can happen again. If you find me, I'll buy you coffee. I'll
buy you coffee.
And we'll become friends.
All right. I like that.
It's the beginning of an adventure. Now I'm just kind of waiting to hear back to see if anybody found my film.
That's Todd Bieber. I spoke with him in New York. You can see the photos that inspired his adventure at our website, npr.org. A couple of weeks ago, we called up Bill Arkin. He's an investigative reporter with the Washington Post. He and another Post reporter, Dana Priest, spent 2 years working on a groundbreaking series of reports that came out last year about the government's vast and secret security apparatus. Anyway, I wanted to know if there was an underground post-apocalyptic U.S. Capitol, a secret bunker for Congress somewhere. So I asked him.
There is.
What is it?
Well, I don't want to say.
Fair enough. But for 30 years, between 1961 and 1992, that secret U.S. Capitol building was behind this giant reinforced steel door. Welcome to Capitol Hill, the day after, except this isn't Washington. It's a giant concrete box nestled into a hillside in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. The story of how it was kept secret for 30 years and how it even got here is stranger than any conspiracy theory. For one thing, it was built as an addition to one of America's most famous luxury resorts, the Greenbrier.
At White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, is the most celebrated of the historic watering places around which much of the history of fashionable Southern society has revolved since the country was young.
This is from a 1948 newsreel story on the Greenbrier just after its grand reopening.
Though Greenbrier's decorative scheme is new, its clientele remains basically much what it has always been. Traveled people of means and background, industrialists and bankers, and well-known public figures like Clark Clifford, White House confidant and advisor during most of the Truman administration.
Bankers, industrialists, government advisors, all hobnobbing at one of the country's most exclusive resorts. And right next door, a post-apocalyptic bunker to guard America's lawmakers. A place you'd go after a nuclear attack. Now, to Bob Conti, that all sounded implausible, crazy talk. He's the official historian for the Greenbrier. And when he arrived here in 1978, locals in White Sulphur Springs started badgering him with questions.
Why is there a 7,000-foot landing strip for a town of 3,000 people? Well, that's so the government could fly their people in here in case of war and go to the bunker that's under the Greenbrier.
But as the historian, as the guy who had to answer questions about the history of this place, you must have been asked about it. People must have asked you, what do you know about this thing?
And I said, no such thing.
Now, here's the thing. Bob Conti really didn't know about it. He knew every square inch of the Greenbrier's property. He had access to all the records and documents and historic photographs of presidents and kings and prime ministers drinking mint juleps on the veranda. But only a handful of people in America knew that just a few yards from Bob Conti's own office was a reinforced bunker that could house all 535 members of the House and Senate in the event of nuclear Armageddon. Behind a 3-foot-thick concrete wall is a space about the size of a Walmart, 100,000 square feet. The air intake system is so intricate, it was meant to filter out radiation, that it creates a vacuum-like effect when you walk in. Wind howls around you and sucks all the doors shut. Bob leads us into what would have been the sleeping quarters for those members of Congress who survived the initial blast and managed to make it to the Greenbrier, A row of metal bunk beds.
So each one of these beds, all they had for private items that you could lock up, was a small little drawer that's right underneath each of the beds. So you could put your personal items in here. And then you had one locker. So that was the extent of what you would have while you were here. And for 30 years, every one of these 1,100 beds was assigned to somebody. It was assigned to a member of Congress.
Every bed was assigned to a member of Congress. Now, to understand why and even how this bunker was built, right under the noses of America's vacationing aristocrats, you have to go back to the mid-1950s when a whole industry built around the construction of fallout shelters started to take off.
In the wake of disaster, you are about to enter upon probably the most difficult and yet most important period of your life, when to escape the effects of radioactive fallout, for perhaps as long as the next 2 weeks, you will be deprived of all the conveniences of modern life.
So this is the late 1950s, and President Dwight Eisenhower starts to worry about how to maintain law and order in America in the aftermath of a nuclear war.
I feel impelled to speak today in a language that, in a sense, is new. One which I, who have spent so much of my life in the military profession, would have preferred never to use. That new language is the language of atomic warfare.
Danger will come not just from blast or heat or nearby radiation effect, but also from fallout.
So in 1958, government workers broke ground on what they called Project Greek Island, and Eisenhower decided the Greenbrier would be a perfect cover. It was just about 4 hours' drive from Washington, and so hotel workers and guests were told that that giant hole in the ground, well, that would house a new conference facility, and in fact it would, or at least a part of it would.
In the 30 years, thousands of people walked in and out of a secret bunker, not knowing that they were in a secret bunker.
Right.
Which was part of the original design.
And they would come in here, and this is what? Where are we now?
This is the exhibit hall.
Okay.
So you'd have the West Virginia Medical Association meeting here. A lot of car companies have met here over the years. So when this was all built, remember, part of the disguise of the bunker was adding this new wing to the Greenbrier, and part of that included conference facilities.
Now, what most people thought of as a conference facility was actually a space designed to serve as an office for all 535 members of Congress and some congressional staffers. Bob Conti leads us down another corridor into a room that was meant to be the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives.
So the overt purpose was another conference facility. The covert purpose was House of Representatives. So there were microphones. You see their little desks they could pull up and have a little armrest there. Little metal attachments there on the back of the seats. They would attach microphones there.
Now, there were a few weird coincidences that Bob Conti noticed over the years before the bunker's existence was exposed by the Washington Post in 1992. For one thing, there were many, many, many bathrooms, and most of them were facilities for men. And the other thing he noticed was this mysterious crew of TV technicians. They worked at the hotel, but they didn't work for the hotel. The company they worked for was called Forsyth Associates, except as it turned out, Forsyth Associates was a cover. These were secret government employees, and they had to keep the bunker in a constant state of operational readiness.
So for that 30 years, you had to make sure all the filters were changed, all the pharmaceuticals were up to date, all the food was ready to go.
And they had to keep a 6-month supply of food that was periodically refreshed. Today, part of the bunker is a tourist attraction. Another part is used as a secure data storage facility, and had it not been exposed in 1992, there's a good chance this would still be the secret home of the U.S. Congress. So today, it's somewhere else, and like the last one, just a handful of people know where it is. And as I mentioned earlier, Washington Post reporter Bill Arkin is one of them, and he's not saying.
If you're a normal member of Congress, my guess is that you know nothing. You really know nothing.
A quick postscript to the story. There's a former software engineer named Larry Hall, and he plans to turn a decommissioned missile base in Kansas into luxury survival condos. And after the recent earthquake in Japan and the nuclear reactor crisis, he's been getting a lot more inquiries. Larry Hall says his bunker will even protect you from radiation, but it'll cost you. Prices start at $900,000. Imagine waking up on New Year's Day at 6:15 a.m. The night before was pretty wild. You're not feeling so great. So you hobble into the bathroom to wash your face and brush your teeth. The year is 2100, and this is how your morning might unfold.
Leaving the bathroom, you wrap some wires around your head, which allow you to telepathically control your home. You mentally raise the temperature of the apartment, turn on some soothing music, tell the robotic cook in your kitchen to make breakfast and brew some coffee. And you also order your magnetic car to leave the garage and be ready to pick you up. As you enter the kitchen, you see the mechanical arms of the robotic cook preparing eggs just the way you like them.
According to physicist Michio Kaku, that's his voice you just heard, all the technology for that scenario exists. It exists now. And he's written about it in his new book that lays out what to expect over the next 100 years. It's called Physics of the Future. And he says, brace yourself for everything from telepathically fried eggs to invisibility cloaks to a doubling of your lifespan to contact lenses that will enable us to
have the internet in our eyeball. We're talking about blinking and you are online.
So it'd be like inserting a colored contact lens, except it's going to be the internet in that contact lens.
And think of what you can do. When you meet somebody, your contact lens will identify who that person is, print out their biography next to that person's image, and then translate from Chinese into English or whatever as the person is speaking.
The printed material will come out from our ears, or?
No, it'll be right in your contact lens.
Remember
the movie Terminator, yes, where Arnold Schwarzenegger sees a person? Immediately you see the description who that person is. Well, in the future, you will have it. You will know exactly who you're talking to, what they are saying in any language as they are saying it. And we have prototypes of this today. This is not science fiction.
This is something that people are really working on. The scientist is really working on it.
People are really working on it. The Pentagon is working on it. They have a version of it where your contact lens lays out the whole battlefield.
You're a physicist. You're a bona fide physicist. You're a well-respected physicist. People know who you are. Explain to me how somebody will be able to invent an invisibility cloak, which you write about in the book. Doesn't that defy the laws of physics?
I teach optics at the university, and for years I used to teach the kids that invisibility was not possible.
Yeah.
Well, I was wrong. And so is every single physics textbook on the planet Earth wrong. When light hits you, light cannot wrap around your body and reform at the other end. Light cannot do that.
Right.
But scientists discovered a new substance called metamaterials, which allows that very fact. Light then wraps around your body, reforms at the other end as if you don't exist. Now, remember that the Pentagon has spent hundreds of millions of dollars perfecting stealth technology.
Right.
And these airplanes are visible. It's that under radar, it's hard to see. It has the image of a large bird. So this is the real McCoy. This is the Harry Potter invisibility cloak. Now, we're not going to have it for several decades, but the basic principles have been proven in the laboratory. Every physics textbook on the planet Earth is now being rewritten.
I'm speaking with Michio Kaku. He's the author of the new book called Physics of the Future. He's also a professor of physics at the City University of New York and the host of the Sci-Fi Science program on the Science Channel. Michio Kaku, you write that within 100 years, we will view chemotherapy as a treatment for cancer similarly to the way we view leeches of the last centuries.
That's right. What killed George Washington? You might be shocked to realize that George Washington was bled to death.
Right.
That's how he
yes.
died. Because back in those days, that was medicine, leeches and bloodletting. In the future, we'll view chemotherapy the same way because we will create smart bombs that knock out cancer cells individually. And believe it or not, we have them already. In trial tests, up to 90% of cancer cells can be zapped by nanoparticles. This is going to be big, real big. Take a molecule, for example,
right.
Very tiny. And cancer cells have large holes, pores in their surface, raggedy large holes. Ordinary cells have smaller round holes, not these raggedy holes. Let's say you create a molecule that's in between the two.
Okay.
That means it cannot get into a normal cell, but slips right into a cancer cell.
Wow.
This is going to change everything. And how will you detect cancer? By going to the bathroom and using your toilet. We have things called DNA chips that are so accurate, using tiny transistor-like things, we can pick up individual cancer cells, one out of a billion. In fact, Mass General Hospital in Boston, in 3 years' time, may begin to market these things on the market.
They already exist.
Everything in the book already exists. I am not a science fiction writer. I am a physicist. And we already have nanoparticles that can zero in on a cancer cell. They've been tested and proven.
Now, I know you're a physicist and you're not an ethicist. I'm not saying you're not an ethical guy, because I know you are. I've talked to you before. If there are microchips or chips embedded in our toilets and in the mirrors of our homes and in our bodies, what about our privacy? What about our ability to be individuals? I mean, it seems, and I hesitate to use it, but it seems big brotherish.
Well, you know, when the internet was first created, it really might have become a big brother. But in 1989, something happened which changed world history. With the breakup of the Soviet bloc, the National Science Foundation decided to give the internet away for free. That changed human history because it meant that a force of democracy was given to the peoples of the world. And also, when faced with new inventions like this, people are a little bit afraid. But just remember that when electricity was first harnessed by Thomas Edison, people were very afraid of electricity. They thought it was intrusive. It's going to go right into your living room. People will be electrocuted and houses will burn down. That's what the critics said. Well, you know something? The critics were absolutely right on every single point. Houses burn down every day because of electricity. Yes, people get electrocuted in their living rooms every day. Yes, electricity is everywhere. And you know something? We love it. So many of the inventions that I talk about in this book, some people may feel, ooh, I mean, that's a little scary, right? But hey, you get used to it. And then later you say to yourself, how could I have lived without it?
That's Michio Kaku. He's a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York. His new book is called Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny in Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Michio Kaku, thank you so much.
Been a real pleasure.
For the millions of teens, and let's face it, grown-ups as well, who followed the drama of Bella, Edward, and Jacob, this is the music that helps tell those stories. I'm talking about the films inspired by the teen vampire series Twilight. And this is music from one of the films, New Moon. The voice belongs to Swedish singer Lykke Li. That delicate voice on the New Moon soundtrack has undergone something of a transformation on Lykke Li's latest record. It's called Wounded Rhymes. Like a shotgun, needs an outcome. I'm your prostitute, you won't get some. And Lykke Li joins me here in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
That's a track called Get Some. There is obviously a bolder, even somewhat provocative sound. There's a line in that song. It's a metaphor, of course. It says, I'm your prostitute. You're going to get some. Why that metaphor?
That kind of just came to my mind, you know. And for the ones who know me, the people who know me, I am, you know, I kind of speak my mind in a lot of different subjects. I didn't even think that it was provocative because I've been here, you know, I listen to a lot of hip-hop, for example, and I've been hearing, you know, all sorts of different words, you know. So for me, it's just natural, you know, to be talking like that.
I've read you say that that specific metaphor is, in a sense, you kind of saying, you know, men can get away with saying certain things, but when women write it, it's different. It's seen differently.
Yeah, and for me, it's very shocking to kind of be talking about power, you know, and to make a statement about how I feel being a woman in the music industry, and all of a sudden I'm labeled as like a victim and a real prostitute, you know. So I think it's interesting, that's all.
It's not about sex.
It's not about sex.
I want to hear another track from this record. This one's called Youth Knows No Pain. Licky Lee, I'm hearing some, I think, 1960s influence here. You've got the reverb and the percussion, the organ. Was that a set that you had in mind all along?
I just wanted to get back to, like, you know, real songwriting. And I want to get back to that human touch and to be, like, in a room and real instruments, live takes. So I think it was just because, you know, we were in a room and there was Hammonds and, you know, drummers and my girlfriends were singing. So I think that's the sound that comes out when you're trying to keep it organic. You know?
Did it surprise people when they first heard it, people who know you and know your music?
No, because I think, I mean, this record actually makes more sense to the people that know me. You know, this is even more me. I think the first record, I was so young and so, I felt so uncomfortable in the studio, so I couldn't really
almost
give.
Vulnerable in your voice.
Yeah, but almost like I had to pee or something, you know, it was a bit too tight, you know, so I think for the ones who know me, how I am as a person, and also seeing me on stage, this record makes much more sense.
This is more who you are.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm speaking with Swedish singer Lika Lee. Her latest album is called Wounded Rhymes. You had a pretty amazing and interesting childhood. I read that your family moved all around the world. Tell me, first of all, where you lived.
I mean, I didn't live like live, but I was born in Sweden and then I lived in Portugal and then we would just travel a lot. So we would go to Morocco, like Nepal, India a lot, and you know, Thailand, America, like New Zealand. Yeah, kind of everywhere. For me as a teenager, I was not enjoying actually.
Did you just want to be home in
Sweden? I wanted to be home, you know, and go to discos with my friend and I always had to be on some mountain somewhere.
But I guess in a sense, I mean, you didn't have that, but in a sense it created a completely different experience that makes you who you are.
Yeah, but it also, I mean, to be me is quite a challenging process because I think that whole sense of home, like I don't know that feeling. I never had it and I don't, so I never know where to go home.
Right.
And I try to ask my mom, I'll call my mom, I'll be like, where should I go? And she's like, oh, I don't know, because I think I'm going to move again, you know? So she just keeps moving, you know? So I lost that sense of home, you know? I know places we can go, babe. Coming home, compound full, babe. And the how I'm faded, babe. Know the how on earth he be.
And of course, when you're here in the U.S., you're identified as a Swedish singer, and people think of you as somebody from Sweden, but that's not really your home.
I don't know. It is to some parts, but it's like a home that I've always wanted to kind of get away from.
Why get away from it? What is it about Sweden that makes you uncomfortable?
I mean, I love it. There's so much great things there, but I think that's just, you know, you grow out of certain things. And also, it's so freaking cold and dark. You can't even imagine. Yeah.
Let me ask you about the Twilight series, because it's become so huge. Did you identify with the story in there at all? Did you feel like this is something that I was meant to do? I was meant to make music for this.
No. I'm so outside of the loops. I didn't even know what it was, you know, and I never read the books or, you know, I don't follow that whole thing. But then I kind of was asking around when I got the offer, and then I just realized that it was this really large, like, pop culture phenomena, you know.
Huge, yeah.
And, like, all these young people, you know, still believing in love and being romantic and, you know, so I really... You know, I remember watching films when I was, you know, in my teenage years, and you would be in love with, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, and then, like, a song would come on. And
you'd love him even more.
Yeah, and you'd love that song forever, too. Yeah. Like, it changed your life, you know? So if I could do that on, like, prime time, then yes.
Do you think years from now, when you go back and listen to this record... Wounded Rhymes. What do you think it will remind you of? Where in your life do you think it will take you back to?
I mean, for me, I'm going to be like Benjamin Button, I think. I'm just going to grow younger, you know. So I think I will probably be, you know, happy, fat, with kids, and looking back and be like, oh, I was such a angry young woman, you know. So probably like dark years before I kind of understood that life is hard, but it's always beautiful.
Happy and fat are not adjectives that we often think of with aging Swedes.
Uh-huh.
But you never know.
Yeah.
That's Licka Lee. Her new album is called Wounded Rhymes. If you'd like to hear a little more, go to our website, nprmusic.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Brent Bachman and produced by Phil Harrell, Petra Mayer, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, and Jessica Deal. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Our intern is Megan Kane. Mathoni Maturi was our editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next Sunday with a new podcast, The Best of Weekends and All Things Considered. And remember, you can always hear the full version of this program, because the podcast is just part of it, on your local public radio station each Saturday and Sunday afternoon.